It's Monday, October 3rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, a formal end to the longest-running insurgency in the Western Hemisphere is up to voters.
If they were to respond, they would be implying that they supported suspected terrorists.
India and Pakistan again at odds. Also ahead, Donald Trump's political tax problems and revenge on the big screen, in a funny way. It's all on today's International Edition. Voters in Colombia are deciding whether to accept a peace deal between the government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, better known as FARC. The referendum comes 6 days after a final peace agreement between the government and the National Guerrilla Movement was signed, bringing an end to the longest-running insurgency in the Western Hemisphere. VOA's Celia Mendoza is at one of the polling centers in the capital, Bogota, and joins us with more on the significance of this vote.
This is a unique process. This is the second time Colombians actually go to a plebiscite. They did it in 1957 when they were changing the constitution to actually allow women to vote and to create something called Frente Nacional, which it was a type of government that Colombians had. This is the only time that we have been able, as Colombians and Colombians in the world, to vote in something like this. Very personal, very unique, and it is the first time that we have a peace process where not the civil society pressure for it, but the actual part on the war. The government and the FARC, who had been fighting each other, decided to actually go to a peace process, and now they're bringing it to the civil society to actually make it come through.
And what does the sentiment of the voters seem to be leading up to this?
It is a particular feeling because we're talking about a country that is looking for peace, but they're divided between the yes and the no. Understanding that from outside is very complicated. If you ask anybody in the world if they want peace, everybody will say yes for it. However, when you are in Colombia, you have a group of people that don't want the guerrillas to be able to have a lot of the conditions that they required during this peace process. We're talking about 297 pages document that was a result of 5 years of conversations in Havana. Now, they're here, they will be able to start a new life, but not just that they will have a new life. Some of them will be forgiven from some of their crimes. Some of them will have the opportunity to actually be part of the government as a political party. They are guaranteed some of these spots in Congress and the Senate, and many others will receive funds from the government to be able to restart life in the civil society. For some Colombians, those type of agreements, they want to make sure it doesn't happen. And that's why some people are strongholds with no. One of them is the former president of Colombia, Álvaro Uribe, who's now a senator and who is leading the campaign of the no. However, for many Colombians, it goes to the point that they say, this is not a real vote for peace. It's a vote for a first step into something that is more of a social justice. And that's what it is complicated. This process has divided the country in a way that we hadn't seen it before, and it has made all their positions very, very vocal, and also it is very emotional. Remember, we're not voting for a president or a particular person. Pretty much people are voting for their future and their family's future.
The outcome of any vote is determined on turnout. What does the turnout seem to be, and how much of a vote do they need to have this referendum pass?
It is actually very interesting. We have over 84 million Colombians voting in the United States and other countries around the world, and also in Colombia. It's the total of all the Colombians that are able to vote and register that can do it. The turnout is actually pretty good. I'm in one of the centers where you can come to vote in the capital of Colombia called Corferias. And as I'm speaking to you, hundreds and hundreds of people are just walking in this particular spot that I'm standing on. However, it is thousands of locations all over the country, and we have seen people since 8 a.m. in the morning just pouring to the streets, going to their locations, making sure that they vote. The percentage is actually very minimum for the plebiscite to be able to pass. It is about an 11% that will be of the total amount of people that are in the census to be able to be approved.
VOA's Celia Mendoza in Colombia. Celia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
The conflict since the mid-1960s displaced millions of people. It left more than 250,000 dead. The FARC has agreed to cooperate with demining, an effort being led by the United States and Norway. Colombia has the second highest number of landmines in the world after Afghanistan, and the explosives have killed an estimated 11,500 people since 1990. It's time now for us to check out what's trending online. G. Abby Lee is in Studio 22 with us, as always, with the hashtags, buzzwords, and much more. Hello, G.
Hello, Jim. No, I'm just kidding. But a lot of people are actually talking about the challah bread in time for the Jewish New Year. Mm. Twitter Moments, which is a section on Twitter that shows curated tweets, included Rosh Hashanah as one of the trending topics this Sunday. Now, during Rosh Hashanah, Jewish families enjoy two nights of dinners, apples, honey, which symbolizes sweetness, and of course, the braided bread, challah. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau took to Twitter to send a video message to the Jewish community. His handle is @JustinTrudeau. American President Barack Obama also sent a video message through Twitter, but not by addressing the camera directly like his Canadian counterpart did. The White House shared a video clip of Mr. Obama having a video phone conference with rabbis in the country, and it captioned the video as Shana Tova, wishing a sweet and healthy new year to all those celebrating hashtag Rosh Hashanah.
Wow, very interesting. Mm-hmm. Well, politicians usually share holiday messages by directly talking to the camera, right?
Yeah, so I thought this kind of veering away from the traditional way of wishing a happy holiday is quite interesting, and to me at least, the less formal way seemed a little bit more authentic. Mm-hmm. Now, let's move on to our next topic. Jim, are you a Star Wars fan?
Oh, yes.
Oh, you absolutely are. Then you have a new Christmas gift for you. There's a new Star Wars merchandise that people are talking about quite a lot, and it's the R2-D2 Coffee Press. R2-D2, as you know, is a robot character in the series, and now you can buy a French press that looks just like it.
So, what's special about this product? Is the, as they say, the force with it? Does it do anything special?
There's no force. Absolutely nothing. It just looks really like the character, but it's essentially like any other manual four-cut French press. It's priced pretty affordably, so a lot of people are jumping on the opportunity to order it, have it as a pre-order. Mm-hmm. That's all for me today, Jim.
All right, well, thanks for ordering up that great wrap-up, G. You can follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE. That's our international edition Twitter stream. And on our individual accounts at VOA Stevenson and at G. Abby Lee. Among the top stories that are trending in Asia, India ratifies Paris Climate Pact. Villagers say explosions rattle houses as usual at Kashmir border. Uncertainty over Philippine president alarms investors. Satellite images show North Korean construction of what could be a submarine. Yuan joins dollar, pound, yen, euro as a reserve currency. You'll find expanded coverage of these stories and more at the voanews.com website and, if you have a smartphone, through our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. There are increasing tensions between India and Pakistan that have been somewhat off of the radar from U.S. presidential politics and also the catastrophic ongoing situation in Syria. But it could turn into something very serious. International Edition's Lori London talks with two former U.S. ambassador of Pakistan and the current president and CEO of the East-West Institute, Cameron Munter, who describes exactly what's going on.
As many of you know, Kashmir is divided, has been divided since the partition of India in the late 40s. And there's a Indian Kashmir and a Pakistani part of Kashmir. There's been conflict on the border over the decades. And there's a so-called line of control that separates the two sides. The problem has always been that there is tension within India among the predominantly Muslim population of the state of Kashmir and Jammu, Jammu and Kashmir, that either is indigenous or, from the Indian point of view, is incited by the Pakistani side. And when they say the Pakistani side, it's very unclear. Are we talking about potentially terrorist elements or even, in some accusations, the Pakistani government? So what happened recently, last week, is that there was an attack by the Indians across the line of control at suspected terrorists in Pakistan. And the dilemma this posed for the Pakistanis was, if they were to respond, they would be implying that they supported suspected terrorists. And it's an asymmetric warfare problem. If there are people crossing the border to cause terrorist attacks, that's fine if the Indians think that they have targets in the Pakistani part of Kashmir. But who then would the official Pakistanis respond against? Obviously not a civilian target, mm-hmm. not a military target.
Right.
So there's kind of a bind. So the long and the short of it is, what happened last week was the Indians went on TV, said that they had made an attack on a terrorist camp or two in what is the Pakistani side of the line of control. And the Pakistanis basically denied that the attack had taken place. And so the tension that you have here is, at a time when India and Pakistan are, when tensions are rising, when, because of unresolved issues between the two countries, India, for example, is refusing to attend a so-called SARC meeting, a South Asian Association for Regional Cooperation, that'll take place in Pakistan later this fall. At a time of rising tension, this ups the ante, this attack. This kind of attack has not been done, to my knowledge, by the Indians, even in times of overt conflict.
What are some of the perceptions on both sides?
I think the Pakistani perception is that there's a legitimate set of grievances by the population of Kashmir, Indian Kashmir. There have been unrest, and there are quite a few Indian soldiers keeping the peace in their own state in India. So that, to the Pakistani side, is seen as reports of oppression, et cetera, of the people in that country. From the Indian side, there's this sense that the Pakistanis are always meddling in Indian affairs, coming over the border into their country, and that it's state-sponsored terrorism is what some of them accuse.
Cameron Munter, former U.S. ambassador to Pakistan and the current president and CEO of the East-West Institute. The New York Times is reporting U.S. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump declared a $916 million loss on his 1995 income tax returns, which the newspaper says such a substantial tax deduction could have allowed Trump to legally avoid paying any federal income taxes for as many as 18 years. VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman joins me in the studio to discuss this latest development.
Indeed, Jim, there's been a lot of mystery and speculation surrounding Donald Trump's tax history. But a reporter for the New York Times happened to pass by her mailbox and discovered a letter sent from someone anonymously with a return address at the Trump Tower in New York City. And it contained several pages, purportedly, mm-hmm. Of Donald Trump's 1995 tax return, in which he put down in losses of about $915 million. Mm. The significance of this, if it turns out to be true, is that under U.S. tax law, if you incur any kind of loss in one year, that can offset any gains you have in subsequent years. And that seems to bolster the case made by the Clinton campaign that, in fact, the reason Donald Trump has not released his tax returns is that the man may have paid no taxes whatsoever for many years.
We'll point out that this particular tax maneuver, if you will, is perfectly legal.
It is indeed. It's not
only
legal.
It just doesn't look good politically.
It's not only legal, it is very common. Anyone who has any stocks whatsoever, I mean, and plenty of ordinary Americans do, if you make money one year or you lose money the next year, it's sort of a zero-sum game in terms of what gets taxed. This is absolutely legal, and it's absolutely ethical. And Donald Trump points out that as someone who runs a business and acts on behalf of investors, it's not only the right thing to do to claim every tax deduction and every tax credit that you can, but that in fact he has a responsibility, an absolute duty to do so on behalf of investors who could sue him were he not to try to squeeze every dollar out of the system that he could.
Americans, for those who own a home, they take a mortgage deduction, which has become kind of sacrosanct over the years, because that is a major deduction against your taxes.
Right.
And on one level, people can relate to that. On another level, Donald Trump would be considered extraordinarily wealthy. That has raised the ire of a lot of people over the years that the very rich, the super rich, pay little or no taxes quite often.
When you are running to be president of the country and you are making a big deal out of America's deplorable finances, it doesn't look very good if you yourself, who have benefited so much from what the country has to offer, is contributing nothing to America's till. But it's particularly bad when your argument to voters is, I'm the business genius. If, in fact, this is proven to be true, that he lost close to $1 billion in 1 year of dealings, it sort of undercuts his argument of being the business savvy guru. I would actually add to the various layers of this story, I would say that transparency has been a big issue in this election, the transparency and the honesty and the forthright nature of the candidates.
Michael Bowman, VOA Senate correspondent, has got all the latest facts. Michael, thank you so much for sharing them.
Always a pleasure, Jim.
And be sure to stop by our website, voanews.com, to follow all the latest twists and turns of the U.S. presidential campaign as we are rapidly heading toward Election Day on November 8th. You can also follow us on Twitter at @VOA_IE and like us on Facebook at VOA Now. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Do you know the political process that determines who the next president of the United States will be? Tune in to VOA's extensive coverage of the campaigns, the voting, and the final tallying to find out how citizens choose their next president. Right here on VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
This is VOA's International Edition. A new revenge comedy starring Kate Winslet and Liam Hemsworth called The Dressmaker is open in U.S. theaters. As International Edition's David Byrd tells us, Winslet plays a woman who returns home to uncover a tragic secret from her past and to take revenge on the people who sent her away.
Kate Winslet stars as Myrtle Tilly Dunnage, a 1951 femme fatale fashion designer, who returns to her hometown of Dungatar, Australia. Myrtle was the only witness to the death of a schoolmate and is branded a murderer and exiled from the town by the victim's father. Now it's 25 years later, and after spending time in design houses in Paris, London, and Milan, Tilly has returned to take care of her ailing mother, played by Oscar nominee Judy Davis. She also discovers that Dungatar is full of secrets, like its police sergeant Horatio Ferret, played by Hugo Weaving, being a crossdresser.
Myrtle Dunnage.
Tilly.
You grew up.
You got old.
Sad, but true.
What have I done this time?
Fine leather can be irreparably damaged by moisture and mildew, Tilly.
How's my mother?
Molly doesn't get out much these days. Did anyone know you were coming?
They'll know soon enough.
Kate Winslet says that Tilly is able to find answers to the questions that have haunted her.
I loved the writing of it. I love the humor of it. It's really a fable. It's set in a fictitious town in 1950s Australia. And I play a woman who comes back to that hometown of hers from which she was sent away when she was 10 years old, seeking revenge on all the townsfolk. And little by little, she gets it. And it's very, very clever.
Tilly takes her revenge by trading magnificent couture dresses for the women of the town in exchange for information. The glamorous gowns seem to have the ability to transform the people wearing them from what they are to what they dreamed of being. Tilly also strikes up a relationship with Teddy McSweeney, played by Liam Hemsworth. Hemsworth says that his character helps Tilly to find out the truth about her past and the alleged murder.
My character sort of allows her to relive that and bring her back to that moment and figure out what actually happened. Because I think because it was so traumatic, she's blocked it out for so many years and doesn't really understand what's happened. And he somehow, I think, allows her to open up and relive it and remember what happened.
Director Jocelyn Morehouse, who returned to the director's chair after a long hiatus, says that Hemsworth and Winslet had wonderful chemistry on the set, which helped make their film roles even more believable.
They were just so fantastic together on set. They were really generous to each other, and they loved the fact that this was a sort of older woman, younger man romance.
Morehouse says a designer friend of hers once told her that couture is a weapon, and that made her want to direct the dressmaker. She said she was attracted to the storyline in which a skilled woman uses those skills to design clothes that transform people and then to use that as a weapon against those same people. The Dressmaker is based on the best-selling novel by Rosalie Hamm. It has won several Australian awards, including 4 ACTA trophies, the Australian equivalent of the Oscars. The film is rated R for brief language and one violent scene. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
You've been listening to International Edition. You can always find us at our website, voanews.com. We're also on Facebook at VOA Now, and be sure to follow our Twitter stream at VOA_IE. Our director is Tracy Carter, engineer Daryl Smith. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us, and we hope your day ahead is absolutely great. Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
On September 23rd, at a Lake Chad Basin side event at the UN General Assembly, the United States pledged an additional $41 million in funding to meet emergency needs for conflict-affected and vulnerable households in the Lake Chad Basin. This additional funding to UN and NGO partners will ensure tens of thousands of people receive critical humanitarian assistance, including emergency food assistance, safe drinking water, and shelter support, as well as interventions to address acute hygiene, nutrition, and protection needs. According to the United Nations, there are more than 2.5 million internally displaced persons and more than 169,000 refugees living in the Lake Chad Basin. During the Lake Chad Basin side event, the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Samantha Power, highlighted the pervasive food insecurity in the region. Ambassador Power stated that the crisis is so severe that an estimated 134 children will die every day of severe malnutrition in Nigeria's Borno state unless treated. And this is just a sliver of the consequences if we come up short on raising enough funds, she said. The United States has now provided more than $359 million in humanitarian aid to this region since 2015. The United States continues to be the largest donor to the area. At the recent high-level meeting, donors pledged $163 million of the $542 million needed between September and December. In addition to the U.S., major donors include Belgium, Italy, and Britain. The United States urges other donors to fulfill their pledged contributions and consider donations of additional humanitarian assistance for the millions of people in the region whose lives have been devastated by Boko Haram's senseless violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.